This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial. The Carol Cox Show on K108, heard every Sunday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. If you have questions for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080.
Welcome to the Carol Cox Show. Another beautiful day here in Hawaii. And Little White Lies, Ella Fitzgerald. Some of you might know that. And just thought I would play that. Has little or no meaning for the show. Just a good song. Anyway, today I'm going to be talking about Laie side and things that's going on out there, and our friend Dr. Jim Anthony is, I have him on the line. He's going to join me on this subject, and as you know, we've talked about it before, and we're talking about the Laie Mormon Church and the Ko'olauloa Sustainability Communities Plan, the Malai Kahana camping situation out there. So it might prove to be some interesting things, and we're going to pick up from where we left off. And good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning, Carol. I think I'm okay.
Okay. Well, I can tell you're doing all right. You're able to punch the phone, and you're still fighting the fight. So sounds like you're doing real good. But thank you for joining me. And there seems to be some new developments, and so share with us and give us a little background, you know, who you are and what you do for some of the listeners that are new to the show.
Well, I've been an environmental activist. I don't mind that dirty term. If some people think it's not very clean, but I'm an environmental activist, and I've been working in this particular vineyard for the last 25 years or so. Do a lot of work on water, and now moved into sustainability, community plans, and things of that nature. That's what I do.
Mm-hmm. And you've talked about this some while back, many a times. But what are some of the new developments, and how? I know that the Department of Planning and Permitting was problematic and presented some problems in their handling and what have you of the sustainability plan. Any new developments?
Yeah, let me pick up on that. There is a call our law sustainability communities plan that was the subject of a lot of discussion by a PAC, community group that was appointed by the city way back, I think, in 2007. And they came up with, the majority of the members of that particular group came up with a certain recommendations. And then there were private discussions held between David Tenoy, now the head of the Department of Planning and Permitting, and representatives of the Mormon Church entities in La Hire, and they came up with another plan. The difference between the two plans is that if the plan that was negotiated behind closed doors is adopted, it would give easy entree to the Mormon Church entities who are anxious to build at least 1,200 homes, some of them market and some of them so-called affordable, even though they've never indicated what the affordable price is going to be. It would give them an opportunity to plaster 663 acres of land that is known as the Gunstock Ranch land. And that land presently being zoned ag would have to be upzoned to residential. So the difference between the two plans is that one will allow easy entree, relatively easy entree, to an upzoning effort, despite the fact that the Mormon Church already owns 6,194 acres of land zoned variously, including residential. Land which the Mormon Church purchased in 1865. So the community has a serious problem with that, in the sense that what plan is going to come before the council, the 2009 plan adopted by the community, or the 2010 plan that was adopted in private discussions behind closed doors between David Tenoy and the Mormon Church representatives.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a looming big issue. In that connection, if you allow me to continue for just one more minute, in that connection, the community has now reacted. A member of the Kualau Law Neighborhood Board, number 28, Kent Panoi Moana, has introduced a resolution following along the lines of the one I think adopted by the Millie Lunny Neighborhood Board, that will provide for no action being taken on any of the sustainability communities plans until the Oahu General Plan is adopted. So that's an interesting ploy.
Mm-hmm.
That I think is very constructive and makes good sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are with respect to the Kualau Law Community Sustainability Plan. We're waiting to see what the City Council is going to do. In the meantime, the City Council is being very heavily lobbied by lobbyists paid for and retained by the Mormon Church entities in La Hire. So
mm-hmm.
That's pretty much where we are on that issue.
Let me ask you, we know that Mayor Peter Carlisle came aboard and assumed the helm at the city as mayor, and he took on the rail. Has he spoken? Do we know where he stands with the issues out in La Hire? Has he even bothered to, or is it just David Tenoy and his crew?
Oh, yes, we do. We do. I certainly know where Peter Carlisle stands on the, what is now being called in parts of the community the Invasion La Hire plan. Peter Carlisle is squarely on the side of the Mormon Church entities, and he has said as much in private discussions with certain people who went to see him very soon after he got elected. So, you know, this is a city administration. Well, it wasn't when Peter Carlisle was mayor, but this is the city administration. Your listeners ought to be reminded. We're handed over, took over the sewage treatment plant that services all the Mormon Church entities in La Hire, and taxpayers are now burdened with that. And Peter Carlisle has never addressed that issue, is not likely to, at a time when the city, administration cries that it doesn't have any money, and it doesn't. We live in difficult fiscal times. We wonder at the good sense of the city council. And by the way, the reason why I mentioned this is that this deal, whereby a privately owned sewage treatment plant is given, is handed over to the city to be administered at taxpayer expense, is a deal that has not been consummated yet. So the short answer to your question, Carol, is that yes, Peter Carlisle does know. He does know that traffic is bad. He does know about, I presume he does know, about the urgent need expressed by all kinds of community groups concerning food sustainability and issues that are related to no more upzoning of agricultural zone land, because agriculture zone land ought to be used for agriculture, and so on. So Peter Carlisle's position, I think, is fairly well known to those of us who are working in the trenches. Whether it's as publicly well known as it should be, I don't know. But certainly I know what his position is.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a call. Caller, you have a comment, a question, or is this Chapman? Hello, caller. Anyway, the gentleman by the name of Stephen Wheelwright, I know in our past conversations, he's one of the leaders or affiliated with the Mormon Church. And you've attempted to get meetings with him, but has anything changed? Has he met with the public or the community out there, or is it just still behind closed doors with David Tenoy?
Well, Steve Wheelwright's kind of an interesting guy, you know. His position concerning the possibility of meeting with me, for example, and maybe some other community people, is still the same. A new initiative was launched by me, I think about 4 or 5 weeks ago, on the advice of certain people who are community activists, but who are also members of the Mormon Church. And it was suggested to me that we go through certain back channels, which I did. And I have had no response from the back channel. So we're still waiting. The message that I have for President Wheelwright, he's the president of BYU, by the way, is a very simple one. That here is an opportunity for the Mormon Church to show that it is prepared to put into effect what Mormon Church teachings are about protection of God's creation, that is, protection of the environment. A more responsible course is for the, with respect to the Invasion La Hire plan, is to keep the 663 acres of Gunstock Ranch, which the Mormon Church entities bought in about 7 or 8, 9, 10 years ago for $10 million approximately, to keep that land in ag, to develop a state-of-the-art agricultural system there that will feed all of the tourists who come to PCC, all of the students who go to BYU, and the resident community of La Hire. The 663 acres is ag zone land. It is perfectly good land for agriculture. They can have a state-of-the-art farm there, and they could do good things in the community, and that would become a model not only for Oahu, it could become a model for the rest of the Pacific and other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. But apparently, Steve Wheelwright is not prepared to listen to alternative proposals. In sharp contrast, for example, to the people who are now managing and preparing the EIS for the Turtle Bay development, the people at the top there are very open. We can talk to them. We may not always disagree, but we have an ongoing conversation. In addition, they have set aside something like 500 acres of land in a community land trust that will be dedicated in perpetuity to agriculture. So you have two different modes of approach within the same community. I mean, Turtle Bay has other problems. They will be, I presume, resolved in some fashion in the future. But there are two different management styles in these two developments that are separated by only 4 miles of highway. On the one hand, the Turtle Bay people are open. They're prepared to talk. I have not had any serious disagreements with them. But I can foresee after the EIS hits the deck that there may be issues that we will be in disagreement over. But at least they're open. With respect to the Mormon Church entities and Steve Wheelwright, the door is firmly closed so far. Steve Wheelwright and his colleagues will not enter into what I call people in the community who have a vested right and a vested interest in what the Mormon Church entities do in La Jolla. So therein lies the difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the City Department of Planning and Permitting, are they aware, I guess, that Wheelwright will not speak openly with the community there? But they're having access to the city. Is the city sharing the results of these behind-the-scene, closed-door meetings?
No, I think the lines of communication between the Department of Planning and Permitting and the activist environmental community and its representatives has never been good. It's frayed. I am not raising any questions about the way that David Tanoe does his job, but I would say this, though. I think that the Department of Planning and Permitting, particularly at the very top of its leadership, that means David Tanoe, has got to change the way that it interacts with the community. You know, interacting with the community as if it were still a colonial bureaucracy is simply not going to work. It hasn't worked in the past. It's not working now. And he's got to change, but I don't see Peter Carlisle, who is, in fact, David Tanoe's boss, I don't see Peter Carlisle having changed at all. Peter Carlisle is still, in my view, acting like a prosecutor. Thinks he's in court trying to prosecute criminals.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Peter is either well-read or well-informed about the shifting professional literature on issues like food sustainability, on issues like protection of aquifers, on issues that concern watersheds. And I think that it seems to me, from where I sit, that David Tanoe similarly has a very limited grasp of these very important overarching issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one thing I definitely want to talk about, and I have Mr. Chapman on the phone, and later we'll bring him in. But on the people's, as it's described, it's park in Malai Kahana.
Yep.
And as it's been described, there's attempts to, by the DLNR now, a separate entity, a state entity rather than a city entity, about various issues, and Mr. Eilert gets involved in this one. Can you briefly, and then I'll bring in Steve, and he'll join us.
Sure. This is the Malai Kahana State Park, which has been managed and run by a nonprofit in the person of guy called Craig Chapman, has been managed by them for the last 17 years. As a matter of fact, they got original entree to this at a time when I was present in discussions that arose with Mike Wilson, who was then head of DLNR and is now a circuit court judge. This is a classic case of DLNR's massive mismanagement of resources that are at their disposal. They have literally, over the last 17 years, they have literally given Craig Chapman the runaround. Literally, big time. He's tried to do everything that he could be expected to do. At one point, he got a $2 million loan. If only DLNR would give him a lease. They promised him a lease way back. I mean, they will argue now. By the way, there's going to be a major meeting on this before the land board on the morning of Friday the 27th, that is this coming Friday. And we're going to do the same thing we do before the land board that we've done before. I've seen the staff submittal done by the land board. But that staff submittal is the classic example of a form of bureaucratic terrorism at work, whereby when they put together a document for the land board, they selectively cull information from their files. I've served them with a Uniform Information Practices Act request to see documents going back 15 years. They said that I would have to pay $1,600 in order to even look at the documents. Forget about copying them. I sent back another request saying, okay, maybe we don't have to go back 15 years, but for the last 5 years, still have not heard from Dan Quinn, who is the head of State Park. This park serves poor people, relatively poor, lower middle class people. It has, in the last 5 years, served between 30 and 40,000 people in cabins that are inadequate. As far as I know, Malika Hanna Partners, friends of Malika Hanna who run the park, with Craig Chapman acting as their executive director, sort of, he has repeatedly, over the last 17 years, tried to get a lease, and Dan Quinn, the head of State Parks, has acted as if this is an Aegean stable problem, that every time Craig did one thing, he then said there are two more things to be done, and this has gone on for a long time. So this is going to be a major community battle. It will probably go to contested case hearing, no matter what the land board does, and then go to court. Mm-hmm. But if it is appropriate for me to say so, this is an example of bureaucratic bungling that has gone on for a long time, and it's certainly not in the interest of between 30 and 40,000 people a year who use this state park, because it is the only one available on Oahu where they can relax with their families, their friends, have family get-togethers, and so on. And now comes Bill Ayla, in whom I am profoundly disappointed. I think he knows better. He should be able to do better. But he is now a complete captive of his bureaucratic staff.
Who is
we'll
this?
We'll see what happens on the 27th.
You say Ayla?
Bill Ayla, yeah.
Okay.
Bill Ayla, for me, is a tremendous disappointment. I didn't expect too much from him because I thought that he was intellectually unprepared to handle this job. I said as much to the governor's office in a recent meeting with a senior staff person in the governor's office. I was bluntly asked, what did I think of Bill Ayla? And I said, well, I don't think of him very often, but when I do, I don't think very highly of him. I think Bill Ayla's lost in the bureaucracy. He's become their captive.
Mm-hmm.
And his whatever little wisdom he might have had has evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fair and honest assessment that I would be prepared to defend anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where we are with Malika Hanna. It's an important asset for the community, and I think DLNR now is driven driven by the same kinds of motives that drove it to drive out the woman that was doing good work in
Haya
Care State Park.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see where this goes. But it's a sorry state of affairs from the public standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you'd hold that thought, Craig and Ipo, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. We're good. How about yourself?
Fine. Sitting here trying to digest this once again and see.
Well, you know, I wanted to say one thing in agreement with Jim's statement about Bill Ayla. You know, we actually, once he got into office, we sent him an email on February 8th, you know, congratulating him on his position and asking how quickly we could meet with him to discuss the situation at Malaikahana. He didn't respond to us until October 6th. This is 8 months after the request.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did respond, he sent us a letter which basically quoted a letter sent by Cynthia Stevens 2 years earlier saying, yes, we must meet.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty lame.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Craig, you were there too, are you?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, one basic observation that I have, and equally I'm disappointed, and for these reasons, and Ayla, as well as my, and I love Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, but two major disappointments because, see, I know they talk the talk, and when they got in, they're not walking the walk. And then Ayla knows better because he's been out there supposedly tugging on the other end with us, the people that were trying to make things right. And so when you incorporate this lazy, lethargic approach to all matters as it relates to the environment and other issues and land use, for example, just last week, I think, or week before last, they have a boat parked, and we pay, the taxpayers pay it to have it in the at Cocoa Head, there in the harbor there, Hawaii Kai. They couldn't take that boat and go outside and look at a whale that was entangled. But guess what? They amassed a force to run to Molokai to protect the rich guys, something that smacks in the face of what Ayla has been complaining about for years. So that's my disappointment, and daily it increases. So, but anyway, back to Malaikahana. You have a hearing on the 27th, correct, before the board. Can you tell us a bit about that and who you are and let the listeners know?
Well, our organization is Friends of Malaikahana, and we're a Native Hawaiian 501c3. We were put together specifically to take care of Malaikahana Park. And we had taken over a two-year lease from Network Enterprises back in 94. And then in 96, went in for a renewal and got a two-year renewal. And then since that time, we have been on a month-to-month revocable permit up until 2006. And then in 2006, I kept on asking to get in front of the board for the renewal of the revocable permit, and we have literally been ignored and stonewalled since that time.
Mm-hmm.
I have numerous emails going to Dan Quinn and at the head of DLNR, Laura Thielen, at that time. The last time that we were in front of the board is when Peter Young was there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just couldn't understand why we were being stonewalled.
Mm-hmm.
So since 2006, we have had no legal standing whatsoever. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've still protected the state with liability insurance, paying our share of the water bill, paying electrical and upkeep, etc. But the biggest problem was in 1996, we had commitments for grants of over $250,000 from three agencies, and all we needed was a 10-year lease.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to upgrade and restructure and put improvements into Malaikahana, and we're refused. And now here we are, 12 years later, and we're in worse shape than we were before.
Mm-hmm.
But we could have taken care of all the infrastructure problems and put free money into the state property,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want to let us do it.
Now, Dr. Anthony, this is a carryover from the Mark, the Linda Lingle era, Mark Young, Laura Phelan. And why is it that the Abercrombie administration comes along and picks up the noose and tightens it, so to speak?
Well, I think the governor has been, if the governor is involved, and I cannot imagine that that Bill Ayala would put the governor's governor's remaining tattered ends of his reputation on the line by trying to evict a Hawaiian organization that has been successful for the last 17 years in delivering adequate services to people in the population who don't have the money to check into Kuilima Hotel, Turtle Bay, or other expensive hotels, and who enjoy a state park. I can't imagine that Neil Abercrombie knows about this, but if he does, it compounds the problem. It means that Bill Ayala is acting without adequate authority. B, he's being politically stupid. And C, Bill Ayala is going to open up a Pandora's box of problems that is going to result in Neil Abercrombie's declining ratings, even declining further. This is going to be a huge. This is going to be a huge event where people in the community are going to be so enraged that they are going to come at not only Bill Ayala, but they're going to be demanding Dan Quinn's resignation because of what I see as massive bureaucratic bungling. Mm-hmm. And frankly, ensconced within Dan Quinn's department, State Park, there are elements there, and I will give testimony on this on the 27th, who are purely racist, who are driven by bad faith, and who have said things to me that will make headlines, I think, if properly reported. So I think Bill is acting very foolishly. He's become the tail of the dog, in the sense.
Mm-hmm.
The bureaucrats now control Bill Ayala.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Ayala, if he's been talking to the governor, has been passing on information. This is the traditional way. I've written on this subject in professional journals. This is the classic way where bureaucrats control publicly appointed officials and create problems for their political masters. So Bill Ayala is going down the road where this is going to, when this becomes exposed to public scrutiny on Friday, Governor ain't going to look so good.
Now, let's make a comparison here. If I wanted to go to the city and camp, it's possible that I have to sit in line for a couple of days in the rain and whatever to get a city. Is that same process, does it take place at Malaikahana?
No, absolutely not. Ever since 1994, we have had a structure where the individual just has to call in, make the reservation as normal business, give us a credit card number or a check for a deposit, and then and they can also book on the web, and then show up, pay the remainder of their fees, pick up their permit and their key, and they're on their way.
Well, I personally have spent a couple of occasions there camping, and It's as close to or as near open camping that I've experienced in the state of Hawaii. It's similar to those places that I've gone in national parks on the mainland.
Right.
And other places. And it gives you that feeling. You're there in the elements. While in the state parks, they don't provide much of anything, and most of them.
Oh, and that's absolutely true. If you ever go onto the web and check the Yahoo travel site, we've consistently been voted number one in all of Hawaii, not just on Oahu,
mm-hmm.
As the safest, most comfortable, and affordable accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we take it as a community that we're taking charge of our guests when they come in. In the old Ho'okipa style, and the way that my wife and our group wanted to keep Malaikahana was the way that we grew up back. back in the 40s and 50s and 60s is that a kid with honey buttered nose is not going to get in trouble. Somebody's going to find him and bring him back to the family.
Mm-hmm.
And we have now had a track record of excellence, and we've taken care of so many people in the community that we were also awarded the Keep It Hawaii in 1996, and 98, and 2000. We give the guests, we think, what they want, and then the guest gives us feedback on whether we're doing a good job or not. And this is purely the opposite of what goes on in government bureaucracy.
And they've raised, I'm looking at some of your rebuttal to the board's request for information and your rebuttal to for submission on the 27th, and there's issues that they attempt to raise on septic tanks. Can you share with the public? Because I'm sure if they read about it, it wouldn't be the details that you can explain.
No, thank you, Carol. And this is wild. Back in 2000, I believe it was 2005, the EPA had contacted state parks on large capacity cesspool closures. Large capacity cesspool is a old cesspool that is going to possibly have more than 20 uses per day. So they had to have everything closed by 2005. The drop dead date was in 2009. When I had read about this back in 2009, I contacted Region 9, Kate Rayo, that was the head of wastewater for EPA, and go, what can I do? And she goes, you're not even on our radar. I go, what? And the reason was, or is, still is because Malaikahana Park is still under R5, residential. It has never been consolidated as far as the TMKs. And so it was still showing on all tax map keys as individual cesspools on a residential lot. So when I asked her, what can we do? And they go, well, you have to put in a system that is approved by EPA that is a non-discharge system and most likely would have to be an aerobic system. I contacted Dr. Roger Babcock, UH Manoa, who is the head of the environmental wastewater, and to help design a system and help us get a R2 discharge off of one of the type of systems that we wanted to put in.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been working towards that end and using the cesspools as a seepage pit. Now we find out that they want it closed. We're saying fine. Either number one, give us a longer term lease enough so that we can get a return on investment, because it's going to cost us at least $100,000. And the state stonewalled us again.
Mm-hmm.
They have never responded to, let's enter into discussions on how we can work this thing out, because the state supposedly has no money.
Right, and no, you know what, but to do the right thing. But one of the things that jumps out at me with this is you are actively running the park. That means that you are advertising, which means that there are people that have actually paid or committed to coming. How is this going to impact that aspect of the business sense? Are you going to be impacted? Are they going to compensate you for that? Or what are they telling you to do?
No, none of the above. We will be negatively impacted, of course, and so will our visitors. And the state is taking this queen of hearts off with their heads approach, that they could care less about families, that this is the only place that they can afford to go and to have large numbers of their family to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Carol, we're the only park now in all of Hawaii that's open 365 days a year. All the other state parks and county parks close down on Wednesdays and Thursdays to supposedly do maintenance, but the main thing is to keep the homeless out of camping. And so what they're saying to us now is that they want to take the park back over, go black, or to put somebody in there as a security guard. We would have to cancel all of our reservations and return the money and ruin people's vacations. And they could care less.
Dr. Anthony, how do you look at this? What Any
well, I look at this, Carol, as a good example of bad government at work. Here is a state park that is being used to productive purpose, serving the interests of people who have nowhere else to go. It is not perfect, Carol. If it were perfect, we'd all be suspicious of it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a park that has worked well for 17 years. This is a park administrator in the form of Craig Chapman, who has tried and tried and tried again to work with state parks so that he could get a lease. They have rebuffed him at every turn. Dan Quinn is part of the problem, not the solution. As far as I know, on the basis of whatever research we have done, I had a documentary made impromptu interviews with people who were at the park on a Saturday and a Sunday. Overwhelmingly, people are very happy with the services there. They feel very comfortable. Many of them are people who have come there time and time again for the last 10 years. I think that Greg Chapman and his wife, people, have been excellent caretakers of this. And if only state parks would do the right thing, and it's not simply state parks, that's not their job, to do the right thing. The right thing must be done by the land board. The land board is where we get our day in court. The land board's obligation is to look at this dispassionately, look at the facts, and make a decision to give Malaikahana Partners, friends of Malaikahana, a lease of a decent duration that will allow them to borrow money on the open market and do some of the things that I think can be done in order to enhance the status of this park. Even though, at the moment, it is perfectly adequate in my view. It is very sustainable. You know, sustainable, sometimes I feel that in order to understand what we mean by sustainable, we should go back and read Alice in Wonderland or Through the Looking Glass. These words are thrown around all the time without any precise meaning. The record is clear. Craig Chapman has done a good job out there serving members of the public. Poor old Bill Ayla lost now in a game that appears to be bigger than he is. His bureaucrats have now disinformed him, and he's going to go to a public meeting at the land board, and he's going to have to face the music, and I hope the land board makes the right decision. And that decision is to give Friends of Malaikahana a 35-year lease, just as the land board not so long ago gave a completely useless organization in Kahaba a 35-year lease on 3 acres of state-owned property. Gave those people a lease, an organization called Winwood something, and gave Bishop Street back financier who runs Kamaina Kids off of state land in Laie. These were all inside jobs in my view, and I know who is involved, and so we're going to go to the land board and make the best case that we can, and then after that, if the land board doesn't do the right thing, we're going to make some decisions that will bring this into sharper public focus.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I'd like to do is remind the public, while this isn't picking on Ayla, let's remind ourselves that he was not inducted, and nor was it a court order that he took this role. And I don't know of any coercive behavior that took place on the governor to make sure that he take that position. I think it could be best described. He volunteered for this position. So with that, I think that he has to own up to all of the good and the bad of it. And one of the things I want to do is speaking of Alice in Wonderland, I want to talk about, play the role of the signifying monkey for a moment. What about the Mormon Church and the invasion, Laie, as most of you now call it appropriately? Are they in the works or the fabric of this process? Or will they benefit in getting rid of you, Craig? If both of you can speak to that. Maybe it's not.
Well, let me just quickly say this, Gal, that I think there are elements within the hierarchy of the Mormon Church operating through the various entities they have in La Jolla. Steve Wheelwright ought to have more sense. He's a former Harvard professor. He ought to have more sense. There is an enormous opportunity here for the Mormon representatives of the Mormon Church entities in La Jolla to do the right thing, even according to Mormon scripture. I am looking forward to the day when there will be the dawning of this light and there will be steps will be taken to move Invasion La Jolla to a more sustainable, a more constructive, and a more community-oriented set of solutions. In all of this, Carol, I certainly am not looking for World War III. What I'm looking for is a set of solutions that we can all live with. And I think that's what we're in search of. And, you know, Ipo and Craig have their own version, and they can speak more than adequately to your question. But that's my position.
Carol, if I may, the standpoint of our part from just the business entity alone is that we're paying over $35,000 a year in GE and TAT taxes, and then also generating well over $2 million a year in ancillary benefits to the businesses of the Colton Loa community. By just coming out and staying at the park and then shopping at the local stores and going to PCC. And again, we are serving close to 35,000 guests a year. And we're the best-kept secret in Hawaii. When people come out and go, why don't you advertise? And basically what my wife and I and our group has decided is that we don't advertise because we want to run the park as word of mouth. That's when you know you're successful.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on our second generation of kids coming out that when we first got there in 94, now they're bringing their kids out because this is one of those places that are warm to their heart. And that's the way that we would like to keep it. And then also back in 2003, there was a bill put out, I believe it was the Senate resolution, it was Senate Resolution 139, for public-private partnerships of nonprofit organizations using state land. And our community-based tourism model was used as the basis for this resolution for state parks to be able to work with different community entities. And no action was taken at all by DLNR. And I just happened to run across it on the Internet when I was doing some research, and I was absolutely aghast. But that's when the RFP had come out in 2003. We were the last person standing. They demanded that we put up $1.5 million plus a surety bond to be able to put the improvements in before any lease was even granted. And then, who was the head of parks at that time as far as the property manager, Jim Springer, said, well, Friends of Malaikahana has to pay for a appraisal. And it was $14,000 for the appraisal on how much the state was going to charge us. I'm going, well, I have no problem with that. But as long as we know that we have the lease, I'll pay for the appraisal. And if we don't get the lease, then the state reimburses us. Springer refused.
Not having a lease, it's difficult to go and get a loan, as I recognize
right.
most
not
of
not only get a loan, but we're rolling a $14,000 debt with the state that hasn't been on the up and up with us through this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went back to my partners and we sat down and chatted about this, and they're going, well, if they can't guarantee us that we're either going to get the lease or if we don't get the lease that we'll get our money back, then no, we're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back and told Springer that, and he goes, well, then that has just squashed this whole deal. And now, from there, we had gone in front of the board to be able to enter into negotiations. And at the midnight hour, being in front of the board, Dan Quinn stands up and says that we can no longer go with these negotiations because they hadn't got permission from the Land, Water, and Conservation Fund, which were the feds that had put up 50% of the money.
Mm.
So it was completely a double standard with us.
Right. Well, let's do this. Jim, if you're an EPO, on the 27th, I'll leave the next Sunday. I'll leave 30 minutes or so, if that's sufficient. Can you come back and update us on the outcome of the decision that was made on by the board in this?
Good.
Coming?
That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, because it's time to keep watching these guys, and I'm not going to make excuses for the governor or anyone. If he don't know, he should have known, and as far as his ratings, I don't think he can get any lower. I mean, just and I don't think your issue is going to make him any lower there. This would just probably.
I wouldn't bet on that, Carol. They can still sink a few more points.
Well, yeah, but no, I mean, he's at as low as you get in my eyes. I mean, nothing seems to be done on behalf of
getting together next Sunday with you is a good idea.
Yeah, please do, and just know that.
Don't you invite Bill to come on your show?
I would love to. I mean, as a person, I admire him, but, you know, when you step in and say, let me on board, and then I'll do the right thing, and if you don't, I have to take issue with you, you know, period.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I appreciate your being continuing to be dedicated to the idea that this is still the land of the free and the home of the brave, and we should talk openly about controversial subjects.
Let's do it. And so are you folk okay with that next Sunday? Call in the 8 o'clock hour?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely,
and keep
Carol.
Us take good notes now, and don't throw any shoes at them.
Okay, sir. No, thank you so much for having us on and being concerned about this situation.
Okay, and thank you so much, and I'll see you next week.
Okay.
Aloha.
Aloha. Mahalo. Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Jim Anthony and Mr. Craig and Epo Chapman from the Malai Kahana Park private entity, and Dr. Anthony is from the Laie side over there, and talking about developments as we've always talked about. And I'll be back in the next hour. So we're going to be talking GMO. And I have Dr. Melissa Yee and also Dr. Hector Valenzuela, Victor Valenzuela from UHCTARC. So please join in, and we'll be back. Take care. Thank you.
the second half of the Carol Cox Show right after the news on KWAI Honolulu, K108.
On the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. All things and what they do, radiation underground in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby. Used to be, what about this old without it? Man, how much more do you from me? Can't you stand?
Good morning again. Welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. As I had said to you earlier in the earlier hour, I was going to talk about GMO, and I have guests here in the studio with me, and Dr. Hector Valenzuela, UH Manoa Professor at CTAR, the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources, and Ms. Dr. Melissa Yee of Acupuncture, and she's here with us talking about GMO, and we'll just get started. And if you could say hello to the listeners out there and give us a little history on GMO and the history of it here, how it arrived here, and who introduced it to us. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you for having us. So basically, GMO crops in Hawaii consist of the seed industry. And the seed industry has been in Hawaii for a long time, since the 60s, because they liked Hawaii for a tropical climate where they can grow three crops in a year. But in the 80s and 90s, the industry shifted from just growing seed to growing genetically modified seed. And genetically modified seed consists of in crossing the species barrier to introducing new types of DNA into plants, to creating plants that have never before existed in nature. And after creating those plants, they patent those seeds, so they can make a lot more money from the seed. So that's basically the biotech industry in Hawaii, and it became a center in the world to do biotech research in the field. And while this sounds great in terms of science and so on, an advancement in science, a lot of people have concerns about the science behind crop biotechnology, in terms of potential environmental impacts, health impacts, because again, you're doing something that has never been done before in history. So when you do it, open field trials, there's a lot of questions about it, about the safety of these experiments.
Okay, and Dr. Yee?
Yeah, good morning. Thanks, Carol, for having us on the program.
Good morning.
We really appreciate getting the word out in any way we can. For the past couple of years, I've been involved in this group called Seeds of Truth, and we have held panels all over Oahu. We've done a TV program called Seeds of Truth and invited experts from Hawaii as well as the mainland to speak about the GMO, just so people can get more educated about it, because I think the majority of people out there know nothing. And so that's why we feel it's really important to start at the educational level and then move to the legislative, and then hopefully at some point even ban GMO from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was an issue with taro. Was that a GMO issue, or was it something different?
Taro was two different issues. One of them was the patenting of the plant, mm-hmm. With normal varieties, traditional varieties, and that the people from Hawaii felt that that was wrong thing to do, to name, claim property over something that belongs to the Hawaiian culture.
Mm-hmm.
And separately, the University of Hawaii was trying to develop a genetically modified taro.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was a concern from the cultural perspective, from trying to modify the genetics of a plant that is considered sacred in the Hawaiian culture.
So it wasn't just an appearance. There are some issues that go with it. Seed in slavery, if they produce the seed, then you can only obtain the seeds from the company. Is that true or in some instances?
Correct. So the idea is you create this new GMO variety, you patent it, and from then on, farmers have to purchase the seed if they want to keep using it. So in the old days, farmers used to save their own seed. They grow a crop, they save the seed, and so on year after year. But with this new model of GMO crops, every time a farmer plants a crop, they have to buy it from the provider. And this creates a dependency. So, of course, for some people, it goes back to colonialism. And colonialism was dependency. You're having to depend on somebody to provide you this, to provide you that,
mm-hmm.
So you don't have as much independence and sovereignty.
The interesting thing about the taro movement was that there was a choice at some point early on whether they would emphasize the cultural aspect or the health aspect. And because kalo is such an emotional thing for the Hawaiian people, they chose to make it a cultural issue rather than looking at the environmental and health risks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they actually engaged so many hundreds and thousands of Hawaiian people to come down to protest at the Capitol and to offer testimony. So it was a big movement. It was very exciting to watch it happen. And I think it really made a difference. It empowered the Hawaiian people to be engaged in something that was so close to them.
So let's do this. You've given me a card here with a variety of vegetables and fruits. Can you go through, because the general listener, name some of the everyday food items that we would experience or come across?
So I wanted to add a little bit to the background of GMOs in Hawaii. So basically, the companies that are doing GMO research in Hawaii, so Hawaii became a center of the world to do GMO research in the field, open field testing of GMO crop of plants that had never been tested before. So the five companies that are doing that in Hawaii are five of the largest agrochemical companies in the world.
So and they are
Monsanto,
mm-hmm.
DuPont, Bayer, BASF, and Syngenta. But their main business is actually the production of chemicals. And after World War II, these companies were the biggest producers of agrochemicals and industrial chemicals. And in terms of that area, they have a poor record in terms of health and environmental safety. So farmers are thought of as stewards of the land, people that take care of the land and protect it for future generations. So there's a concern in Hawaii that our most valuable land, who will be taking care of it? And if we place it on the hand of big agrochemical companies, will they be taking care of the land, or will they be using it, extracting the resources and degrading the land for future generations?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the big question marks.
So I think what people don't realize is that this has been done so sneakily. Governor Caetano, in his attempt to bring in people who would revive the agriculture industry, thought that it was a good thing to bring in the GMO companies. And so he wholeheartedly supported this in the 1990s. And I was involved in the fluoridation issue at the time. I was really concerned that the fluoride that they were using was not a pharmaceutical grade. And so we as a group got together. And although the CDC and the Department of Health put so much money behind supporting fluoridation as a means of helping the kids of Hawaii, they failed because the people rose up. Even the dentists started to pull back and say, no, we should have freedom of choice. We shouldn't put a unknown hazardous chemical into the water.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing that at the time, and I heard out of the side of my ear that something was happening in Wailua with these companies coming in and starting to grow these crops. But I didn't really get engaged until the taro issue happened. And that's when I realized, this is something that we really have to be concerned about because this is the food we're eating every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, I've gotten more educated, and I've looked at all these issues, and I realize this is crucial. We have an urgency here, which the legislators and the council members are not aware of. So we put out this little flyer when we went down to the legislature this past Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
We passed out this little flyer telling people, if you're eating soy, corn, canola, cottonseed, or rainbow papaya, you are consuming GMO. So a lot of people I've spoken to have said, oh, I eat papaya every day because I know it's good for my digestion. But then they start talking about gastric problems, colon cancer, stomach cancer. So you know something's going on with these foods, which these authorities are saying is totally safe to eat,
mm-hmm.
but it's causing side effects.
Mm-hmm.
So even your soy sauce, your tofu, your edamame, the soybean oil that you're using in your cooking every day, canola oil. People are switching to soybean milk because they can't tolerate the cow's milk because it has the bovine growth hormone in it.
Mm-hmm.
Even your aburage and your tofu and soy lecithin that you're taking for reducing cholesterol, these are all made from GMO.
Mm-hmm.
So then when we're talking about corn, it's the same thing. Vitamin C is made with GMO corn. Some people, when they take those supplements, they get a funny reaction, and they don't realize it's because it's genetically modified and not so much because of the product that they're consuming.
And so to combat this or educate people, what are you proposing? What is proposed? Labeling of sorts, or should all things be labeled, or what are you proposing?
We're proposing that people become educated about this, because even if they hear 5 minutes about GMO, they realize this is wrong. It was put on the market without sufficient testing on humans. But who would you subject as a human to be eating this stuff, which could cause side effects and even more serious long-term effects?
Mm-hmm.
So they took it from the rats, put it on the market, said that soybean is good for you for women going through menopause. They didn't talk about the aspect of soy affecting the thyroid or the fact that this soy was genetically modified. So now we've got all those other side effects, and people are developing these health problems, and we don't know that the connection is related to the genetically modified organism.
So one of the key aspects is that so far the products that have been released into the market, they have no benefit to the consumer. There's no improved nutrition or so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the traits that have been introduced so far have been to make it easier for farmers. So far, there's only a few crops that have been genetically modified in the market. These are corn, cotton, soybean, alfalfa, sugar beets. And the major traits that have been introduced are related to pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is our herbicide-resistant varieties, so that you can douse the crops with herbicides and they won't die. The second type of crops are inserted with a pesticide itself. So every cell of the plant contains a herbicide. So the whole model or concept of GMOs today is centered around the use of pesticides. And this is why critics say this doesn't make sense, because it's back to the old ways of farming,
mm-hmm.
relying on pesticides and more toxics.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't sound good in terms of health and nutrition.
Good morning, Carly. You have a comment or question?
To the woman that talked, Dr. Taro, the Lee, I don't know your name, ma'am.
Dr. Yi?
Yeah, I'm a taro farmer, and to me, you make no sense. You're counterproductive. You want to make a better taro plant? You guys have been crossing taros for a long time, and you sure haven't solved all the terrible diseases. So I think genetically modified taro is great for the Hawaiians because they can eat more taro. And if, you know, effects of this stuff, I remember very well, I think it was 93, 95, the first GMO was tested off concrete in the Oxnard, California. If, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that was the first one. And there's no bad effect from taro if people didn't drop out.
You're breaking up, caller. You're breaking up.
And just leading up all these trucking figures, I'd sure like to see him. All these people will drop like fire the GMO parts.
Okay, caller, we can't understand what you're saying, so...
I'm so sorry.
Try calling on another line, or find an area and stand still for just 5 minutes.
I don't see no results of all the scare tactics of facts and figures of people dying from GMO products. And I think it's the wave of the future. We can't stop it. It's science. I think Mr. Venezuela would understand that. But if we do science with some kind of, head on our shoulders and thinking, maybe we can solve some of the problems that GMO may cause in the future.
Yeah, it's Dr. Valenzuela, and he's from Guatemala, Venezuela. No, I'm just joking, Bob.
The big scare thing is that you've got to scare people by not eating facts and figures.
Yeah.
This woman talked about a lot of headaches and cancer. That would show up pretty quick, man, because like I said, a lot of people in the United States of America are eating GMO food. And one question to the Mr. Venezuela, is the GMO gene, is that passing on to all the papayas in the state?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll try to answer that question then.
You guys have a nice day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you for the call. One issue with taro has been facing some cultural problems over the past 2 or 3 decades, but a lot of the production problems can be attributed to using industrial production practices based on large-scale monocultures, based on the use of high levels of pesticides and fertilizers. And Hawaiians were able to grow taro successfully for thousands and hundreds of years by following proper ecological production practices. Once you start destroying those methods, by destroying the lois, by changing the water pattern, by removing water and shifting it to Central Oahu instead to the rivers, to the mountains, you start seeing a decline in production.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually not a problem with varieties of taro. There's tons of varieties of taro that you can select to use in different areas in the state, and some of our resistant to diseases and so on. But we have seen a decrease in the number of varieties available. So once you have a narrow germplasm, you start seeing problems as a result of the method of production.
Mm-hmm.
So GMOs really weren't answering any questions. We were trying to fix a problem created by industrial methods of production.
What information is available that has been produced by to refute claims on the side of the, we'll describe it as the environmentalist or the person concerned with GMOs? What is the company's offering as a rebuttal? Is there a formal study on their part that follows the consumption, the growth, and have they taken issue with these claims that the other side is making?
Well, basically, in terms of regulation, these crops have been deregulated. Based on decisions by the government, they claim that GM crops are substantially equivalent to conventional crops. So really there's few requirements in terms of health studies, but the few health studies that have been conducted by industry itself.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems in terms of identifying any causes, effects on the population is that GM crops are unlabeled. They are not labeled. So once they are spread into the market, there's no way, if there's any health problems in the population, it's real hard to track down to a specific crop.
Mm-hmm.
Because the crops are unlabeled.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to talk a little bit more about this term, sustainable equivalence, substantial equivalence. This is a term that was developed in the 80s by the government in connection with the industry to say that a GMO food is almost the same as regular food. But it's different because we're patenting it and we're profiting it from it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start to look at the animal studies that have been done, and even those have been controlled by industry, they would distribute the data that was more beneficial to their cause to make a cause for continuing to experiment with GMO. But you saw pretty significant evidence that these rats were having smaller organs. They eventually became infertile. They couldn't have babies anymore. The babies were very weak and died. The digestive tract and the reproductive organs were the most significantly affected by the consumption of the GMO by these animals. I believe there were a couple of human studies done, but they were stopped early on because people started to have strange reactions to the food.
What are these studies, the one you're citing on the rats? Where can the listener go and read that? And
well, there's a few studies that have been conducted on independent referee journals, but there was a review conducted last year, and this scientific paper said the number of health studies continues to be very limited.
Mm-hmm.
That means there's not, you would expect hundreds of studies looking at the safety, especially if we're all consuming it, but mm-hmm. those studies have not been conducted to date.
And in this state, are we equipped to study? Do we have the ability or the capacity to follow one group of people to see the health department?
The science does not allow for that because mm-hmm. the industry is controlling the science. So if you Google GMO health effects, GMO risks, animal studies, human studies, you'll find that there are very few human studies done because it was not allowed by the industry. And when it was conducted on the animals, it was pretty significant what came out with the independent studies that these animals were definitely being affected.
Mm-hmm.
But we're being experimented on a daily basis because when we're eating these foods, fully unaware that they are GMO, and then we start to get stomach ache and we start to get colon problems, we can't have children, and people go through that whole fertility clinic treatment, and they still can't have a child. Something else is going on, but you can never trace it back to the GMO, and that was probably intentional.
So the digestive flora in humans, has there been any studies that would seem to be where they would focus on, Doctor? Has there been any studies to track the impacts on GMOs on digestive flora?
Well, one of the concerns has been because we're introducing different bacteria and virus genes mm-hmm. into the genome of the plant. One of the concerns is that these bacteria would interact with bacteria in the gut, in the stomach,
mm-hmm.
and transfer genes that are undesirable to our health. And the industry claimed that pro-scientists claimed early on that this could not happen. But it has been proven recently that indeed it is possible for some of this DNA that we're introducing that had never before been in those plants does indeed move to the gut. And there was a case recently reported of this toxin, the BT toxin that's introduced into the corn, that was found transferred to the fetus. So we know that it's happening, but we don't know what are the long-term ramifications.
Mm-hmm.
So the health studies that have been conducted today are based on animal studies. And some of those animal studies have raised red flags in terms of organ disruption, reproduction, immunity. But the human studies have not been conducted because the product is, again, unlabeled. So with drugs, usually the drugs are labeled,
mm-hmm.
and you conduct what is called post-marketing studies. And about 50% of the drugs are recalled or the labels are rewritten because there was some problem found with post-marketing. But with GMOs, this is impossible to do because the crops are unlabeled. However, in other countries, like in entire Europe, the crops do have to be, GM crops have to be labeled. And in Japan, there's also labeling requirements.
Yeah, actually, I know the lady who was involved in pushing for GMO labeling in Japan, and she said she knew one of the ministers there, and so she campaigned with others to really look at this issue. Even though they didn't fully understand from a scientific point of view, they went ahead and supported the people by labeling any foods that were coming into the country. So now we've exported the rainbow papaya to Japan, but it must be labeled. And then there are definitely going to be side effects. I can even cite one person that came to me at the farmer's market. She was telling me that she's from another country and she used to eat papaya all the time. She moved to Hawaii, started eating the papaya that was grown here, and she started breaking out and getting very sick from it. So this is only anecdotal. You know, we're not here to do the studies.
Right.
Science should be doing the studies. Anyway, she told me she started breaking out and got very sick. And then she narrowed it down to the papaya she was eating every morning, thinking it was healthy for her and thinking that rainbow or Hawaiian papaya was a good product. She finally eliminated eating the papaya, went back to her country, ate the papaya from there, did not get the reaction, came back to Hawaii, started eating the papaya again as an experiment on herself, and found that when she ate that rainbow papaya, she got the reaction. If she ate organic papaya, no reaction. So the reaction is only something that's coming out externally, but we don't know what's happening internally to the gut, to the stomach, to the blood. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the aspect of the Roundup that's been spraying on the fruit and the vegetables. Nobody talks about how dangerous the Roundup is.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk. Go ahead.
See, another aspect is that the crops that are genetically modified, corn, soybean, cotton, they are highly subsidized by the taxpayer. And the American Medical Association has come up and said, we, as an American in the U.S., we are have the wrong diet because of these subsidies of cheap food, of fast food, and so on. And they're saying we should move away from these crops, which happen to be genetically modified. And they're saying, and I will quote from a study: the poor quality diets supported by this system contribute to 4 of the 6 leading causes of death in the United States: heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and some cancers. And these are foods that include genetically modified crops.
Now, how would you describe the lobby here, the GMO lobby in this state? And then if you could speak to, you're going to the legislators now and trying to educate, and what are you seeking to get from this effort?
Well, it's kind of like a last-minute thing that we're involved in, because these lobbyists have been going to the legislators for the last 20 years. They've got a lot of money behind them. The Hawaii Crop Improvement Association has been putting a lot of time and effort into giving campaign money to the legislators, to the council members. So they had a head start.
Mm-hmm.
I only came into this about 3 years ago because I was so concerned. And I draw the parallel to fluoridation again. There was a lot of money behind fluoridation from the Centers for Disease Control. The Department of Health was backing up Mrs. Caetano to put out a commercial to say, we need to take care of the keiki of Hawaii. You know, please, let's put the fluoride in the water. But a small group of people was actually able to turn it around. And so Seeds of Truth, GMO-free Oahu, YC, Kahea, all these different groups are coming together now and saying there's an urgency here, because this has been on the market for about 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and people are getting sick, but we cannot trace it back to the fact that it's the GMO that's doing it, because we're eating all kinds of chemicals. We're consuming the pesticides, we're consuming food additives, preservatives, MSG, God knows what else.
Mm-hmm.
Even the pesticides are causing those kind of health reactions. So we're telling the lobbyists, we're not telling the lobbyists, but we're telling the legislators, look, the lobbyists were already here, but you only heard one side of the story. And whenever we try to hold a panel, people will say, well, you got to have the other side of the story too. But these guys had a 20-year head start on us, so here we are coming in trying to re-educate the politicians, and they have no listening for that.
Has anyone identified any of the legislators that have received donations from the GMO companies?
Absolutely. Russell Kokoban, who's now the head of the Department of Agriculture, was one of them. He was a farmer on the Big Island and a senator, and it's been documented how much money he's received. But
mm-hmm.
he was so pro-GMO when he came into this Department of Agriculture head that there was no way anybody could convince him otherwise, that organic or even conventional farming was a better way to go. You were using less pesticides, but with the GMO, you're definitely using a lot of pesticide and herbicide and chemical fertilizer. So you're depleting the soil, you're taking away all the microbes, you're killing the soil, and God knows what it's doing to the people who are eating those crops.
And has he been introducing bills or courting legislators to benefit the GMO companies?
He will always bring up that term, substantial equivalence, saying, this food is okay to eat. Who are these people to say that it's dangerous, it's risky? Even the caller who called, I don't think the man really knows enough about GMO to realize how harmful it is to our health.
Mm-hmm.
So he is only one. We know of Calvin Say, Cliff Suji, Clarence Nishihara, who are the heads of the agriculture committees,
mm-hmm.
that they've been compromised. We try to talk to them, and they say, no, there's no concern here. Because I know it's the lobbyists who've already convinced them that GMO is fine for Hawaii and we shouldn't be labeling, not wasting money on labeling. And so therefore, they're not even going to give an ear to what we're saying.
One of the things that helped the industry is that our policymakers still have the idea of the plantation, of big farms. And when they think of agriculture, they think we need big farms in Hawaii to keep the industries going. But I think it's the other way around, that once you look at economic studies, small farms are actually the answer for Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
especially now that we're talking about growing food for our state, self-sufficiency. We need a cadre of small farmers and all over the islands to grow our own food. And when you look at the economic value of the industry, people don't realize that the farm gate value of the seed industry in Hawaii is zero because there's no sale of the crop. Now, policymakers come and say the value is $250 million or so on, but this is numbers that were provided by the industry to the DOA, and they're comparing apple to oranges.
Mm-hmm.
The farm gate value is actually zero, and you have to realize that these dollars are not staying in the state. They're spending money for fertilizers, for pesticides from out of state, but the dollars that they're contributing, not all of them are staying in the state.
And they will eventually become enslaved, potentially, to the seeds, to the fertilizer, and so you won't see the resale of it, of the fertilizer. A distributor might make some money, but it's coming from out of state.
And again, are those companies really committed to the land and to the preservation of the land in Hawaii? We know that some they just pick up sheep and leave when they are not pleased any longer. BASF just left Germany. They said we're not longer going to do any GMO crops in Europe because they're not welcome there, and we're going to move to the United States. Monsanto left Kauai in 2009. Another big plantation, Del Monte, they just picked sheep and left Kauai overnight. So are they really here to take care of the land over the long stretch?
Mm-hmm.
And their track record has always been, go to a country, whether it's India, Brazil, take advantage of the farmers who are there, who are so gullible and trusting that they think that this is going to improve their crop yield.
Mm-hmm.
The farmers get sold into buying their chemicals exclusively, only using their seeds for one season, dying from the toxicity of the pesticide and the herbicide, and eventually committing suicide because of the loans they've taken out, they're not able to repay.
Mm-hmm.
So they've actually drunk the Roundup and the other pesticides to kill themselves because they're so desperate that there's no way out of the situation.
And they see that I've read a story where they actually see their land lost because they're so in debt to the... And the company takes the land.
That's right. And then now the soil is so depleted, but the only way they can keep it going is by putting more herbicide and pesticide into the ground.
Mm-hmm. So there's a... Well, first of all, this is the Carol Cox Show. My guest is Dr. Hector Valenzuela and Dr. Melissa Yee. We're discussing GMO. And if you'd like to call in, 524-1080, 524-1080. Tell me, there's the decline in bee population, honeybee, which is important in pollinating various fruit crops and crops. Is this really a suspect, GMO products, is in the decline of bee population? Is there any proof?
Actually, I'm a beekeeper, and I became a beekeeper this past year out of concern that the GMO was affecting the immune system of the animals, of the insects. And so to do my little part in my own yard, I got a hold of two beehives, and I see that they have this symptom called crumpled wing virus. So some of those bees will be crawling around on the lawn, and they're unable to fly because their wings are deformed. And I went to a bee conference and heard many speakers talking about the problem. This actually started way back in about 2007. I wasn't a beekeeper then, but the beekeepers lost like 60% of their beehives because what was happening was that the immune system was being compromised. They blamed it on the virus, but actually these bees were being used to pollinate the fields out in Kunia and in Wailua. These were GMO fields where they were spraying enormous amounts of Roundup. The bees would take the pollen and the herbicide back with them to the hive, infect the others, and their immune systems were compromised, so they all got the virus and died.
Good morning, caller. Have a comment or question?
I heard on the radio that the City Council of Maui recently passed a law requiring that GMOs be labeled. And so the person that was talking about it said that you can't get it done through the senators and the state or the federal government, but what you can do is you can get your city council and your local government mayor to pass legislation doing it for your county.
Well, really?
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, that's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks
Thank
for
you.
Calling. I was down there at the city council on December 7th when the Hawaii Council was also having its hearing about GMO labeling. Maui had already passed the labeling bill in the county council. Kauai passed the bill, a resolution to support the bill to label GMO, which would be passed on to the state legislature. Hawaii County and Oahu heard the bill, heard the resolution on December 7th, but actually the city council had already decided to take that bill out of their package that they were going to send on to the legislators, and they did not pass the resolution because they said, well, let's leave it up to the people who really want to have non-GMO food. They can just go to the health food store and buy it there. We don't want to take it on because it's going to cost too much, blah, blah, blah. That was their excuse of wiggling out of the responsibility of looking at what the GMO was doing to people's health and also labeling it properly. I mean, consumers have a right to know. You know if there's aspartame in the food, you know if there's MSG in the food, you know if there are food additives. If you're sensitive to them, you're not going to eat them because you're not going to buy those products. So there was an attempt by the counties to pass this labeling resolution, but because the City Council of Honolulu refused to touch it, that resolution did not pass on through those package of bills that were sent to the legislature. So we're having to start all over again in the legislature because the counties were not successful. But I do believe that it'll happen at the county level because this is where the strength is. Maui, Kauai, and Hawaii counties have already shown that they want labeling. It's just the people who are working in the city council that are too scared, or maybe because they've been influenced by the lobbyists, they're not going to touch it.
So, again, all of the counties passed resolutions in support of the labeling bill, except Oahu. And the number of testimonies that came that day overwhelmingly supported labeling. And, again, the council members of Oahu said, we don't want it. With respect to the bees, one of the problems with Industrial Ag is that you start having interactions with the bees, and a couple of papers came out just over the past couple of weeks showing that pesticides used for crop production, including a seed treatment that is used for growing GMO corn, is interacting with the varroa mite and with diseases to weaken the bees. And these studies believe that the interaction of pesticides and diseases is weakened, causing this colony decline all over the United States and the world. So again, it's a result of increased monocultures, increased pesticide use, and with all these technologies, you always have to ask, who's benefiting, who's getting the profits, and who will pay any costs down the road if there's any social problems of health, diseases, and so on. And we can see that the big companies, the big seed companies have the profits, but the public is left to pay any potential costs in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Now, digressing a bit, the City Council of Honolulu, what was that resolution? When was it voted on? Do you know?
This was actually even before December 7th. That was a general meeting.
Of 2000.
of this past year, yeah.
Okay.
December 7th, they had a hearing, a general hearing. That was their general meeting for the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Previous to that, there was a committee meeting with Tulsi Gabbard at the head where they looked at the resolution. First it went to committee, and then it went to the bigger meeting. And they saw this resolution to label GMO, and they said, no, we don't have enough time, so we're going to look at it later. But, of course, all the lobbyists were there to testify against the resolution.
So Gabbard was the chair of this committee?
Yes, Tulsi Gabbard.
So was this bill heard, or she concluded that? Did she schedule for passing it on, or was it heard in her committee?
It got very limited hearing. There were some people from Occupy Honolulu there who were there for their Bill 54. Mm-hmm. They were testifying on that. So they testified against the GMO, in favor of the GMO labeling. All the lobbyists were there. They knew about that meeting. So they were there and said, it's going to increase the cost. GMO is fine to be eating. There's no problem. Why are we labeling it? Why are we putting that burden on the government? So this committee, I believe it's called the Economic Development, I'm not quite sure of the name, but they decided in committee, no, we're going to take this resolution out of this package of bills that we're sending to the legislature. We're not going to touch it. Maybe we'll look at it later on, but we're not going to do anything about it now. So by the time, a week and a half, December 7th, when that big meeting was held, because we had created such an uproar by calling the council members, emailing them,
mm-hmm.
just making a big concern known to them, they allowed us to speak about it at that meeting on December 7th. But again, they had already decided, we're not going to touch this.
And so the bill was shelved.
The package passed on to the legislature, but the resolution was not approved by that city council. And Tom Berg made a very valiant effort to try to introduce they called it a floor draft, but basically it was a resolution to put signs up to show that there is GMO products in this area of the market.
Okay,
but
so
that didn't get enough support.
They pulled the resolution, and this was in Gabbard's committee.
Yes.
And do you remember the resolution, resol number?
If you go on the...
Oh, we can find it. Maybe.
Yeah, okay. It's 11-339.
Okay.
So you can see all the testimony online, and there were so many people who testified. We had.
And all you're asking is just to have it labeled. You're not asking to ban it. This was just to label it.
Yeah, at this point, you got to start somewhere.
Well,
a new bill has been presented by Senator Mike Gabbard in the legislature to label fish, genetically modified fish, and label genetically modified produce. So this probably would cover corn, soy, papaya. Those are the main crops we're growing here that are GMO. To label those foods, let's start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But the legislators are already telling us, no, we're not going to go there. Maybe you should just go to the health food store and buy the non-GMO labeled foods.
Okay.
So it's, to me, a real cop-out on their part.
Basically, it's just to protect the right of informed consent for the consumer. Just like with farmers, there's a movement to try to protect the farmers' rights, the right of farmers to save seed, just like they have saved for generations.
Mm-hmm. Like cigarettes, over the years, they were thrust upon us, and we were smoking, and we couldn't
it's
be a
good
real
for your
man.
Health.
Couldn't be a real man if you didn't have some smoke.
Even today.
And then came this big bombshell, and now they're struggling. You have to label that it's certain and what have you. But yet GMO comes and plops down on your doorstep. And again, for clarity, you're not asking that it be banned in this effort. You're just, first of all, wanting it to be labeled.
Yes, we have to start somewhere because it's so pervasive in the market. Probably as much as 70% of the food we're eating now has GMO in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why people have to start reading labels. They have to start getting educated. But it would make it a lot easier for us if that GMO aspect was labeled and we could choose to buy that food or not buy that food.
Now, you mentioned fish, and a great many people said, why are we worried about this? We've been breeding fish to come up with this and breeding plants and flowers. Doctor, what would you say to that, speak to that?
The concern, again, is that you're introducing genes into these organisms that had never existed before. We're crossing the species barrier. First is the concern, how is this fish going to be for my health?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, if it turns to be the wrong kind of gene, what if this gene contaminates wild species?
Mm-hmm.
And then you contaminate the entire food chain. So then it becomes an environmental disaster. And this is part of what is called unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that industry, the nuclear industry, the energy industry, the oil industry, they try to minimize risks. But unintended consequences is something that happens because you didn't expect it.
And this is what's puzzling. I don't know why there's such a battle, because we see it in many species, quote, alien species. We know that if one species is introduced to an area that, in an environment that really, for better way of the existing species or the native species, have adapted to a unique way and not capable of fending off this intrusion. So it would possibly be the same thing with bacteria and genes, correct?
Right, and it's part of the process of evolution. The reason species naturally don't like to cross barriers is because they are adapted over thousands of years. Accepting genes that work, and over thousands of years, they become very efficient. When you introduce a gene overnight, you really don't know the consequences, because we yet don't understand how genes really behave. They may help with a specific trait, but it may also start producing a lot of proteins that we didn't expect them to, that they would produce.
That's why the definition of GMO has to be really clear, because people are saying, well, hybrids have been around for thousands of years. We've been hybriding. You know, this has been happening in nature all along. How is GMO different? No, you're inserting a foreign gene. And in the case of the fish, they've already got a salmon on the market that they would like to get approved. This salmon has been crossed with a trout gene to make it grow faster, grow bigger. And people are opposed to this. This is happening on a national basis.
I think the worry and the key is it's a modified gene.
Right.
One that every lock has its own key, unique. So man comes along and say, I'm going to modify a key that will fit 90% of the locks, and there you have the problem. Now you, one guy get one master key or one modified key, or the same thing with, and when they leave, let's say they pick up and leave from Germany, do they sterilize the soil? Do they, what do they do? You know, I mean, there should be a cleansing, because there's certain conditions you're concerned with.
And we know that we have made that mistake before. We did it with the plantations in Hawaii. We had a history of plantations, and when the plantations ended, when you looked at the soils, they were sterile, they killed the life, they were polluted, the aquifers were polluted. And what are the health effects of all the many years of pesticides in the aquifers? We really don't know, because we haven't conducted those studies, but we know that a lot of people are getting sick.
Right now we know that the residents of Waimea on Kauai have brought a lawsuit against Pioneer there, because they've let these lands lie fallow. The
mm-hmm.
people are inhaling the dust from the herbicide that's left behind on the soil. The children are getting sick. This dust is settling on the houses, on the cars. So that's a good initiative on the part of the residents to take Pioneer and hold them accountable for what they're doing, and
mm-hmm.
have them reveal what exactly is in that soil that's flowing onto their house.
Well, know that egrets were brought here for good.
Look at the mongoose.
Mongoose. And so and those are things we can see. So you're in your right to ask, at least to have some concern.
So we made those mistakes before.
Yeah. Good morning, caller. Comment or question?
Question. This is directed to Mr. Venezuela. I don't think he heard me. The GMO gene that's in the papaya that the university developed, does that pass on to other succeeding generations of papaya trees in the environment? So is GMO genes in all the papaya? Is that true or false? I'll take the air. Answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
The concern is that over the years, you can start transferring the pollen and the seed, the contaminated seed, to other fields. So 50 to 60 years old, it is possible that a large number of the plantations, the papaya farms in Hawaii, would have contaminated papaya seed.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible for them to transfer by pollen, or by just you putting some seeds in your pocket from a fruit that you ate, and giving it to your neighbor down the road. And your neighbor could plant that seed, and your neighbor wouldn't know that he has papaya, and your neighbor can give it to his neighbor, and so on.
Well, real simple. I occasionally do some gardening when I'm not lazy. But in past years, you grow broccoli next to cauliflower or what have you, and you have cross-pollination, and you get this weird cluster, this umbel of fruit or what have you. So it's genetics.
So we saw it in the movie The World According to Monsanto, that samples were taken from the mountains of southern Mexico, deep in the mountains, where you found the natural wild species of, or semi-wild or domesticated species of corn, and they found contamination in the most sacred lands deep in the mountains of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that if we had done this with taro 50 or 100 years down the road, we could have found contaminated taro all over the islands. And this is a real risk, because if there's a new disease, like we had with corn blight in the 70s in the U.S., we go to the native species, to the wild species, to get that resistance, and that would no longer be possible.
Wow. So anyway, we're coming down at the last couple of minutes. Anything real quick you'd like to part with?
I just want to mention a positive thing. What is the answer? The answer is moving towards small farm production and ecological farming, and that's becoming a consensus in the world, that we should move away from GMOs towards ecological farming.
Mm-hmm.
The positive thing is with children. The children are now developing these school gardens, and some of the produce that they're gathering from their own gardens are being used in the cafeterias. That's wonderful. However, people have to be aware that in many cases this program is supported by the biotech companies. This is not something that's just happening on its own with initiative from the parent-teacher association.
Mm-hmm.
The biotech companies are involved there, too. So I really encourage people to get educated about this. They can just Google GMO on the Internet. Thank God we have the Internet that's not been regulated yet. And learn more about it on your own. And you will see that we're not just speaking off the top of our heads. There's solid evidence behind this.
How can people reach you, or is there a website they can reach you, Dr. Valenzuela?
Yeah, if you Google my name, Hector Valenzuela, Hawaii, you'll probably find my contact information.
Okay, and you, Dr.
They can go to our Facebook page. It's called Seeds of Truth. They can go to GMO Oahu, GMO Free Oahu. That's a new website that's come up. They can go to Hawaii Seed. They can call me at 292-1179.
Okay.
And I'd like to talk with these people. Anybody who has a concern, we're more than happy to gather a panel, gather people, and talk to them about it. And the majority of them will be convinced after hearing us talking just for 1 hour like today.
Mm-hmm.
This is wrong. We need to have the right to know. We need to have this food labeled.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Valenzuela and Dr. Lee. Thanks again. And we'll talk about it later, and if there's any lobbyists or company would like to come in and talk, maybe we can get the two of you, the three of you inside.
That would be great.
Okay, well, thank you again. This is the Carol Cox Show, and we'll see you next week. Aloha. Etta James, as you know, she passed, and one of my favorite singers and performers. So, life will go on. And by the way, we just lost another police officer. You need to slow down, folks. It's a sad commentary about our humanity when we're out killing people that's protecting us. Slow down, drive smart, and be wise. So, see you next week. Hello.
Was wrapped up in clover. The night I
thank you for tuning in to the Carol Conference.